The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Ben Stein wrote the New York Times, "There are almost no investment geniuses. The only ones I know of are Warren Buffett, John Bogle, and Jim Rogers." Jim Rogers is considered one of the most astute global investors of our times. I first connected with him years ago when, before he took his, I guess it was his first or second, I'm going to ask, when he went around the world on a motorcycle. And, but he has been, he's been an amazing person in our industry. In fact, in the world of commodities, which I used to be a commodity broker years ago, he is the person that we listen to. He co-founded the Quantum Fund and retired at the age of 37. And he continues today. He and his family live in Singapore, and we'd like to welcome Mr. Jim Rogers to the show there. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Oh, Mike, I'm so delighted to be here. Good morning, Peggy.
Good morning.
Well, I want to ask you, first of all, is the boat race going on this weekend or next weekend?
Oh, my gosh, it's this weekend. How'd you know? Yes, I won't be there. I won't be there, but they're going to do it without me.
Well, you made it famous years ago, but yes, I was reading your book last night. By the way, your book is fascinating. I was trying to think of a way to introduce it and talk about it because, folks, you've heard me recommend books before. I'm going to recommend this is the number one book that I have ever read. It's called Street Smarts. It's Jim's latest book. And I don't even know where Barnes and Noble would put it. It's a business book, but it's also an adventure book. I'm not even sure what section they would put it in. What I would say is that, you know, Jim Rogers when he wrote this book, he brought his wealth of Wall Street experience and the storytelling ability of Mark Twain. And I just think, Jim, you have written a fantastic book. And in that book, you were on the rowing team at Oxford, I guess, and this is the big weekend for the big boat race between Oxford and Cambridge. Is that correct?
This, in fact, is it. Mike, I'm very impressed that you've done your homework. I was known as the coxswain, or cox, if you want to know how to say it. Yeah, I also coxed at Yale, but I had much better success at Oxford than at Yale.
Well, and in fact, you were only the second American ever to do that, correct, when you did that?
I was the second American, and the first American sank, so they were pretty excited that I was going to sink, too. And by the way, Mike, I was the first person from Alabama ever to cox a boat race.
Well, you're the first person from Demopolis, Alabama, that I've ever spoken with.
Well, I was also the first person from Demopolis, Alabama, to cox a boat race and to go around the world on a motorcycle.
Oh, wow. Well, I want you to know, by the way, Jim, that I was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, and the second town I lived in was Decatur, Alabama. So I got close to you over there. What do you think?
We're redneck, aren't we?
Yeah, we are definitely rednecks. We've been around a while. I've been in the business 38 years. I'm 62 years of age. I've been following you for a long time and very much admire your clear view of things. You've been honest and straightforward over the years, incredibly accurate in your forecast. I've just got to ask you, and since you are the world traveler, you've been around the world twice. I think one time you logged in 152,000 miles in 116 countries in one of your trips around the world. What do you think of what's going on in Cyprus here? It seems to be a far more serious situation than people are recognizing here in the United States.
Like, first of all, it is just totally outrageous. I mean, they're rare in human history that governments just come in and steal your money and tell you they're stealing it, but they're doing it. Well, actually, this time they call it a contribution. They're saying that all of the depositors are contributing to the stability of Cyprus. I mean, it is terrifying. I mean, I am now making sure that I don't have over 100,000 in any bank anywhere in the world because this is a precedent. And if the next time a government, including ours, needs money, they're going to figure out a way to come and just snatch it away from you. It is terrifying for everybody listening to this show, whether they're in America or Europe. It doesn't matter. This sets a terrible precedent. And it's the IMF, you know. It's the European Union and the IMF. So it's the whole world involved.
And, you know, Mark Mobius, and I know you know Mark, and, you know, he's been around a long, long time also. And he came out this morning and said that he feels like Europe must default, that there must be defaults in Europe. and that's the only way out of this. Do you see the Eurozone really going into default?
Well, absolutely. I mean, somebody's got a default. By the way, I see the same thing in America, too. We're propping up bankrupt, and we should stop doing it. No, absolutely. The way the system is supposed to work, Mike, is if somebody fails, they're supposed to go bankrupt. Competent people come in, take over the assets, and you start over from a sound base. What we're doing here is we're taking the money away from the competent people, giving it to the incompetent people, and saying now you compete with the competent people with their money. I mean, it's absurd economics. It's absurd morality. I mean, politicians don't care about morality, but this is very dangerous. The way you solve the problem is to let people who fail go bankrupt.
And obviously they're not doing that. We not only bail out banks, but we bail out corporations here in America. And that doesn't seem to work. You know, there's a history. I look to Japan, because, you know, Japan seems to have laid the pattern that we seem to be following here, where they've tried so many things, none of which have worked. They've been at zero interest rates for almost two decades. Their stock market has lost 75% of its value, and nothing seems to work over there. Are we going down the same path that Japan has gone down?
Very insightful of you. Absolutely. This is, you know, the Japanese for 23 years have said we're not going to let people fail. They prop up zombie banks. They prop up zombie companies. And their stock market is down 75% from 23 years ago. We already have one lost decade by some people's estimate. We're certainly going to have one or two lost decades ourselves, Mike. This is not going to work. It never has.
So what do you think the end of QE2 is? I find it very interesting because I've interviewed several folks from the Fed, and when I talk to them and I ask them that question, they don't seem to have an answer. I know that apparently it's not in any textbook, and all of those 200,000 MBAs that you say we graduate here, they don't see any of them seem to have an answer of how this thing is going to end. How do you think this is going to end with the QEs?
It's going to end very badly for you, Peggy, me, and everybody listening to this show, because they don't have a plan. They don't know what they're going to do. These are the, you know, I don't know if you remember, but in 2008, the head economist at the Federal Reserve wrote a paper saying, we have hundreds of the best PhDs in economics in the world here, and there are people out there who are saying that housing is going to collapse. We say it's not. How can they possibly know as much as we do? You know the rest of that story. This is the same Federal Reserve that says they're going to solve the problem. The way it's going to end, Mike, eventually the market's going to say we're not going to put up with this anymore. They're going to drive interest rates higher. The Fed's going to try to fight it. They're going to buy more bonds. They're going to go deeper and deeper into the hole. And eventually the Fed's going to fail. Hallelujah. The world without the Federal Reserve will have problems, but the world with this Federal Reserve has more problems.
All right, so you don't see a good end to what's going to happen here. Do you have any idea of the time frame here? And I know you're not in the predicting business probably any more than I am, but do you think that this is going to come up in the next? Are we going to deal with this in the next couple of years? Because Bernanke and company seem to be hinting, for instance, that even they think they may have to raise interest rates by 2014, maybe 2015. Do you think we're just within the next few months or few years of seeing some of this contagion begin to happen?
Well, Mike, it probably won't happen until, well, there's a German election this fall, so I know Mrs. Merkel's going to do everything she can to keep good news coming. Whether it's artificial good news or not, it doesn't matter. So there's going to be more good news coming out of the largest economy. Europe is the largest economy in the world, so for a while, so at least until the fall. But I would be very worried for the end of this year of 2014.
There is a section of the world that you are positive about, and that seems to be Asia and a growing dominant force in the economy of the world.
Well, Mike, I don't like saying it since I'm an American like you, but you know, America is now the largest debtor nation in world history. No nation has ever gotten itself this deep in debt. But the creditor nations of the world, the largest creditors are China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore. Whether we like it or not, there are massive assets in Asia and massive debts in the West.
Yeah, and we're going to end up owing them everything, I think. If I understand correctly, they pretty much finance all this debt that we seem to be piling up here in the United States, and there seems to be no end to it. But now there have been some news that there was a big 60 Minutes show a couple weeks ago that got a lot of attention about China building cities that no one lives in. I've never been there. I know you've been everywhere. Is that true? I mean, are they creating some bubbles over there?
Well, first of all, Mike, there are going to be problems in China. Every family or individual or company or country which rises has problems. I've seen overbuilding in China since I've been going there for nearly 30 years now. So, yeah, there are going to be problems. 60 Minutes is a little late. I mean, this criticism has been around for 3 or 4 years. It hasn't collapsed yet. But, Mike, let me emphasize, there will be problems in China. There will probably be problems everywhere that rises. So this is not going to be a free lunch for them any more than it is for anybody else.
Okay, now
Let me also say that if one had left America, you know, when we had a civil war or when we had depressions or something, one would look pretty foolish over the next century. And that's my view of China.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Hey, Jim, would you be up to taking a phone call? We've got Lee in Houston that would like to ask you a question.
I would love to speak to Lee in Houston.
All right.
All right, Lee, welcome
ahead,
to the
Lee.
Show.
Yes, no, thanks. Jim, are they using natural gas vehicles down in South America? I've heard that may be what we'll go to here. And I thought maybe you could explain your commodities fund. I've been tracking it, but I've never bought it, and I wasn't sure it was performing up to what the market is doing.
Well, they are beginning to experiment with natural gas vehicles in South America. What's more prevalent down here is cars that burn fuel based on sugar, especially in Brazil. They've been doing it for over 35 years now. They've been converting sugar into gasoline, and a large part of their fleet runs on ethanol made from sugar. They're also starting to experiment with natural gas, although not nearly to the extent we are in the U.S. As far as the commodities fund, Lee, it's an index fund. Nobody manages it. As you know, index funds, if the items go up, it goes up. If they go down, it goes down. Commodities have been going sideways for a few months, several months now, so it has not been doing as well as it did before. But in my view, and who knows whether I'm right, I'd rather be in commodities than stocks at this stage of the world economy.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Lee. Thank you for your call. And by the way, if anyone would like to call, we will be happy to take your calls. The number is 877-711-5611. Speaking of commodities, Jim, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, because I would like to know myself, what are your thoughts on like gold? Gold gets a lot of attention right now. But of course, we've got Warren Buffett out there who doesn't like it. We've got half the people on TV who do. What are your thoughts on gold and silver and precious metals right now?
I own precious metals, Mike, and I've owned them for decades, in fact, years anyway. My worry is that gold has been up 12 years in a row, and you're old enough and I'm old enough to know that's extremely unusual for any asset any time in history. And so gold wouldn't surprise me if it didn't have a correction. It's overdue for a correction. It's only had one correction over 35% in the last 12 years. That, too, is very unusual. If it goes down, Mike, I hope I'm smart enough and sovereign enough to buy more. I mean, there are things that could knock gold down. Whether they happen or not, I don't know. But if they do, I'm a buyer, not a seller.
Now, are you basically optimistic on commodities, if I understand your answer to Lee? Because I know in your book you talk about some positive signs for America, and you mentioned two of them specifically. You mentioned one in agriculture and the other in shale gas and oil. Are you positive or optimistic, at least, on commodities in general?
Yes, that's mainly on commodities. That's my portfolio. Well, my portfolio is complicated,
right,
many things, but I do own a lot of commodities. You know, if the world economy gets better, Mike, there's going to be shortages of commodities. If it doesn't get better, they're going to print more money. And throughout history, when they print a lot of money, the way to protect yourself is with real assets. Now, I'm more optimistic about agriculture than I am about others. I mean, Mike, you and I should have been farmers. If we'd had brains, we would have stayed in the South and become farmers. You know,
you know,
it just shows how smart we were.
Well, you know, I started out that way. You and I were talking over the break, and I started out on a soybean, tobacco, and dairy farm in Mississippi and Tennessee. And I'll have to admit, Jim, back then when that old hot sun was coming down on me and I was suckering tobacco in July, I didn't think it was such a good idea. Now as I see farm prices go up, in fact, I'm astounded at the price of the acreage that I tilled on all those years that we have had, you know, it's an extremely strong market. And it seems to me, in fact, kind of mentioning and taking into consideration what you said in your book about shale gas and oil, that, you know, the demand for energy and food are the two things that go up every single day, because we have 175,000 new souls a day on this planet. As you travel the world, do you see that demand, the tremendous demand for energy and food everywhere?
Absolutely. I'm down in Chile right now at a conference making a couple of speeches. And, you know, Chile has just boomed in the last 10, 20 years. It's amazing. It's just about everywhere I go, at least outside of Europe and the U.S., things are doing very, very well. And, yes, there are more people every day. I'm really optimistic about it. And, Mike, you said it right there when you said none of us wanted to stay on the farm when we were young. Well, nobody's becoming a farmer now. The average age of farmers in America is 58. You know, we're running out of farmers. In Japan, it's 60. In Japan, it's 66, the average age. So, no, unless farming becomes even much, much, much more attractive, we're not going to have any farmers.
We've got some callers. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Fine, thank
Great.
You. You have a question for Jim?
Yeah, I want to make a comparison between the QE and the Enron situation. From the way I understand it, the main reason Enron went down as fast as it did is because it was getting loan guarantees to take care of its daily operations, and when those loan guarantees dried up, everything collapsed. Is that a correct analogy or close?
Well, some of that's correct, yes. That was part of their problem.
Okay. Are we setting up the same situation with QE popping up these banks, and when QE stops, then is the same thing going to happen with the banks that were popping
Bobby,
up?
Well, Bobby, it's very insightful. Yes, we have a huge artificial situation now. There's a lot of money being thrown out the window, and the people who are getting that money obviously are in better shape than the ones who don't get it, and, of course, it distorts interest rates and the bond market. Now, when this ends, somebody's going to be on the wrong side because they're going to suddenly find that this artificial prop, these artificial, well, not but indirect guarantees, they're going to see they're gone. They're going to look out the window and say, oh, my God, now what? And you're going to have some serious problems, including, I would say, in the Federal Reserve itself. This is not going to be fun in the end.
Yeah, I agree. Credit unions, I'm concerned with them going the same way as SNLs. Did you comment on that?
Well,
I got to hang up and listen to you on the phone, though.
Okay, thank
Bye-bye.
You, Bobby. Yes, as I said, Thanks. Some people are going to wind up being on the wrong foot when we come out of this, and many SNLs probably will be among those, just like many credit unions, just like the SNLs were once before, and many bankers. I don't know who. I wish I were smart enough to own up so I could sell them short. I guess we got to continue to listen to Mike and Peggy's show so we'll know who to sell short. But no, somebody, including some credit unions, including some banks, are going to be losing huge amounts of money when this ends, and it's not going to be fun.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that the end of this is not going to be pretty. There's not going to be any way to get out of this, I think, without some pain. All right, let's go to the next caller, and let's pick up Ben. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike, and thank you, Jim, for the interview. Based on your outlook, the pessimistic outlook, the bleak outlook of not knowing how all of this will end worldwide, where do you recommend we put our investments for lowest risk possible and capital preservation?
Well, first, Ben, as Mike's just got through saying, there is going to be pain. We can't have 50 years of excess and then suddenly just wake up one day and say, okay, well, that was fun, but now we'll start over. No, when you have 50 years of excess, there has to be some pain. And I want to quickly add, Ben, yes, I'm very pessimistic about some things, but I'm wildly optimistic about others. I explained earlier in the show that I'm very optimistic about agriculture, about farming. I'm positive about, well, the Japanese stock market, for instance, right now. And I hesitate to say it, but I've actually gotten optimistic about Russia. I've been bearish on Russia for 46 years. That's not a typo. For 46 years, I've been down on Russia. Now I'm becoming positive. So there are good things happening in some parts of the world, including in the U.S. I mean, move to Oklahoma, move to Nebraska, move to Iowa. I mean, I hasten to tell you, Ben, that I'm not going to move to Iowa, but there are going to be wonderful things happening up there. So in the meantime, find things that you know a lot about, such as agriculture, such as energy, maybe some countries in the world, and you will do extremely well even when things are going badly. And if you have money and you don't know what to do with it, just put it in government bonds until you know, of short-term treasury bills until you know what to do. Don't think you've got to be investing all the time.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Thank you very much. Yeah, I think that people need to err on the side of caution. I agree with you. Before you leave, I just have to ask, what are your thoughts on India? I can't seem to figure that place out. And I don't know if it's going to be a great country or whether or not it's internally it's such a mess that it's going to hold it back. What are your thoughts on India, Jim?
Well, if you can only visit one country, Mike, I would urge you to visit India. There's no country
is that right?
to visit. Like, if you can, I mean, I just go because it is so extraordinary. It's a constant sensory feast in India, no matter what you do. But it's a place to invest, not with my money. I mean, it's a bureaucratic nightmare. They've got their debt to GDP is up almost to, it's over 90% now. The bureaucracy is a disaster. The internal divisions are a disaster. Not with my money, but by all means, if you haven't been to India, go. It's just extraordinary.
Okay. I've never been. But I know it's someday, you know, I've read that, we're not in the not too distant future, China will of course pass us a GDP. But I understand that at some point out there around 2030 or so, India is scheduled to pass China. But it seems to be much less organized. And I know there's a lot of corruption over there, but, you say as a place to visit, it's a great place to go.
But not to, so. And I would dispute. I don't. It's not going to surpass China in 2030. That sounds like something that comes from the World Bank or somewhere. World Bank's never been.
Yeah,
right,
if actually,
so if it comes from.
You know, I think it did come from the World Bank. As a matter of fact, I think you hit that on the head.
Don't pay any attention.
One other question for you, and then we'll let you go. Is there anything that, I mean, we've talked about a lot of things that really worry you. What is your primary worry right now, and what can we do about it? What is the one thing that's really on your mind every day?
Well, the Federal Reserve in America. I mean, because they make constant mistakes. They're printing staggering amounts of money. They're taking huge debt that we didn't authorize them to do. No, it's going to end terribly, and with a massive inflation or massive collapse. No, the one thing that worries me the most about the world as I go forward is the Federal Reserve, because this is going to lead to more wars. I mean, you know, it's leading to currency wars. It's leading to, when you have currency wars and you have interest rates flopping around, that's why people get unhappy. That's why you have people going into the streets. That's why you have governments fail, and eventually you have war. No, these guys are a disaster, unmitigated disaster. If I haven't made it clear, Mike, read the rest of my book, okay? You'll see.
I will. That's what I'm going to do this weekend. And thank you so much, Jim, and I hope you will continue to advise us over the years. I have been following you literally for decades, and you have just been you've been a light at the end of the tunnel, and I hope you'll continue to do so. And, folks, I hope you'll go out and buy the book. It's called Street Smarts by Mr. Jim Rogers. Jim, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you very much, Mike. Let's do it again sometime.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.